Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man of relatively tender age, of uncommon intelligence, is our first guest. His name is Benjamin Weingarten. He is a senior contributor to The Federalist and a fellow with the highly regarded Claremont Institute. I just caught up with something you published about a week before 60 Minutes got around to it, namely an important essay at The Federalist about China's efforts to obtain legally or illegally the DNA and other private medical information of millions of Americans. In fact, the 60 Minutes piece, which aired on Sunday, as you know, featured a comment from Bill Evanina, who was a director of the Counterintelligence and Security Center for the United States government, and saying that 80% of us have had that data expropriated by the Chinese through a company called BGI or otherwise. Tell us what we should make of such a situation, Ben.
Yeah, I think it's critical to put this in context. Communist China's obvious part of their grand strategy is to be the dominant player in any number of strategically significant fields, one of which includes genomics. And this company, BGI, is, I think, aptly called by some in the intelligence community and commentators as well, the Huawei of genomics, particularly aptly because this is a de facto, if not de jure, state-backed enterprise which has done research work in collaboration with the People's Liberation Army, which has had Chinese Communist Party or state backing on the financial side, and which it has been tasked with administering the Chinese National Gene Bank. And what BGI has done is seek to exploit the coronavirus crisis to get its equipment and potentially even its lab up and running in America. BGI itself has links to Huawei through a big data analytics partnership. So you can imagine the myriad ways that our national security, our very health, our life and limb can be threatened to the extent that you have a CCP-backed company that is collecting our most sensitive health data, namely our DNA. And it also just perfectly illustrates the nature of the CCP, that it would exploit the coronavirus for which it is most culpable by offering, of course, you know, under the guise of wanting to provide COVID testing and helping out Americans, essentially another Trojan horse to further pilfer our most sensitive information. And this isn't even to talk about the more nefarious aspects of what China does with genomics, which could involve DNA editing and modification, targeting of specific populations, and even weaponization, of course, as well.
Well, I do want to talk about precisely that, Ben, as it happens, because what they're doing to the Uyghur Muslims and other ethnic minorities in Western China raises a concern that in addition to genocide, as former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has declared it, in the form of brutal repression and incarceration in prison camps and forced labor and forced sterilization and institutionalized rape and the like, could take an even uglier turn if the Chinese were simply to decide that they wanted to exterminate these people using highly efficient techniques like tailored, genomically modified viruses for the purposes of their mass elimination, could they not?
Yeah, and look, even just the very notion that they would have our most sensitive data can be leveraged against us in any number of ways so that they don't have to go to the most extreme usage of it. But let's point out specifically with respect to the Uyghur genocide in Xinjiang that the U.S. Commerce Department has blacklisted two of BGI's subsidiaries in connection with, and I'm quoting here, their work on quote, genetic analyses used to further the repression of Muslim minority groups. That's all you need to know about BGI and its subsidiaries. And the fact that they actually are even able to operate in America at all should outrage every American. This goes back to their acquisition of a DNA sequencing company back under the Obama-Biden administration, which was able to pass CFIUS review, helped them become not only a dominant player globally in genomics, but also gave them a foothold in the U.S. And unfortunately, their tentacles here have continued to grow in spite of the fact that the Trump administration's Indo-Pacific strategic framework was premised on the notion that China would seek to dominate in genomics to further their authoritarian ends. Really a disaster. And the fact that there were, as I write in this article, a couple of leaders in two American agencies who actually pushed for BGI's products to be taken up in connection with coronavirus testing is a scandal of the highest order.
It really is. And the fact that it has gone on for so long and not been even warned of, let alone correct, is very alarming. Just to add a further level of concern about all of this, there was a Chinese defense minister in the early 2000s who apparently made a speech to trusted party cadre that has been leaked to the West, in which Ben Weingarten, he talked about Deng Xiaoping when he was the dictator of China in the early 1990s, launching a biological warfare program that would ultimately have as its purpose eliminating the population of the United States so as to clear the way for the Chinese to colonize this country. If indeed the Chinese, and by the way, Gordon Chang has attested to this on this program, that their own open source materials, as you've indicated as well, suggest that they are pursuing such a genetically manipulated program for targeting specific populations, we ourselves may be the victims of this kind of data migration.
Yeah, look, I think every single possible means has to be considered in terms of the arsenal that the Chinese Communist Party would use to become the dominant world power. And I believe to make every other nation in the world, peoples in the world, effectively vassals of the regime. And so obviously, you know, there's the unrestricted warfare book, which goes through the myriad ways that they might pursue, particularly asymmetric warfare against a conventionally strongest adversary, namely in the United States. But our policymakers and our thinkers on this have to consider the whole range of potential nefarious ways that China will seek to be the dominant power. And my suspicion is that they would like to pursue probably the path of least resistance, namely continue with what they're doing. Xi Jinping talks about the torch of multilateralism leading the way forward in a speech recently to the Davoise. And of course he would pursue that, because that multilateralism has created all the leverage and the strength that China needs to allow the West to essentially hamstring and kill itself and become inextricably intertwined with communist China. So I suspect they will pursue any and every means dependent on the resistance that they face and the nature of the strengths of their adversaries. And so, again, our policymakers ought to consider every possible exigency.
We have to leave it at that. Ben Weingarten, the general that I'm talking about too, is the defense minister, is Chi Haoqian, and his speech is really required reading. You can find it at J.R. Nyquist's blog and at the Epoch Times. Thank you so much for your time today, Ben, and great reporting work as always. I hope you'll be a frequent guest of ours here on Secure Freedom Radio in 2021. Take good care, my friend. Next up, we will speak with former Ambassador Pete Hoekstra, new figure in the Center for Security Policies team, about the state of the world, among other things, and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. And I want to say I could hardly be more excited about welcoming our next guest for a number of reasons. He's a good personal friend. He's a man whose service to our country in a number of capacities, including in the United States House of Representatives for many years, in the course of which he was the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. Then more recently, his time as the U.S. ambassador to the Netherlands. He is now back from overseas assignment, and it thrills me to say, for the first time, that he is now a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy and the chairman of its newly resuscitated advisory board, both positions which I think will enable us to work closely with former Congressman, now former Ambassador, Pete Hoekstra. Congressman, Ambassador, it's so good to have you back stateside and with the Center for Security Policy team and here with us on Secure Freedom Radio. Welcome aboard, sir.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you. It's good to be with the Center for Security Policy. I'm really looking forward to the work that we can get done over the coming years.
Me too. One of the things that I know you'll be paying close attention to, as is our president, Fred Flights, who worked with you very closely on the committee staff back in the day, is the phenomenon of the politicization of the U.S. intelligence community. And Pete, you've seen this close at hand. Of course, we all watched it, I think, become evident horrifyingly, in connection with what the intelligence community did to both President Trump personally and to his presidency, starting before he came to office and then in the course of much of his time there. Give us your sense of both the magnitude of that problem and its implications.
Well, let me go through this in kind of a few layers. Number one, you're right. I spent a lot of time with the intelligence community, being on the Intelligence Committee for 10 years. And then, of course, having the opportunity to work with the people that are stationed overseas when I was ambassador to the Netherlands. And the first thing is, these are very, very smart people. When you take a look at the different agencies, the people who are involved in human intelligence, the people that are involved in gathering electronic data, that operate in cyber world, the people that operate in space and fly our space satellites. I mean, they can do amazing things. And sure, there have been intelligence failures, but they haven't necessarily been failures of collecting data, collecting information. They are a vacuum cleaner that sucks up information. The second thing is, it's been very, very clear, they are focused on our external enemies, the threats external to the United States of America. Therefore, they operate under a very...
By law, they must do that, right?
That's right, by law. So they operate under a very specific set of rules and boundaries that say, you know, you focus externally. You cannot be involved internally. And those laws and those boundaries are very different than what domestic law enforcement works by. So they gather great information. They're focused externally. But what we've seen in the last 4 years is that it has become weaponized. It has become politicized. You know, it was targeted at the president, the former president, some of his campaign managers, and other people involved with the Trump administration. And it's an illegal place to go. It is an awful place for our intelligence community to go. We continue to have external threats that are very, very serious. We need our intelligence community to abide by the law and stay focused on the external threats. An intelligence community needs the public's support and trust. It needs the support of our political leaders. It can only do that by staying in the lane that it has been prescribed. If it ever, you know, there are people now talking about, well, you know, we need these kinds of capabilities to focus on the threats inside the United States. I think one of our former CIA directors said, including, you know, maybe even libertarians, now calling out a political stream of thought in the United States that might be a threat that would warrant investigation or monitoring by our intelligence community. That is that's a very, very dangerous place to go. It is a threat to every American's liberties and freedoms. You can't go there. You know, it's just, you know, there was a reason it was set up for external forces, external threats, and it absolutely needs to stay there.
Let me ask you, there is a domestic security arm of the U.S. government, of course, the FBI. It is part of the intelligence community, but you're absolutely right. Pete. The vast majority of its assets and capabilities are, again, statutorily required to be focused externally. But what about the FBI? Have you been shaken, as I have, by its ineffectiveness in addressing the sorts of threats that we saw last summer from groups like Black Lives Matter, the organization, and Antifa, to say nothing of, you know, what seemed to be foreign forces like the Chinese Communist Party that seemed to be in various ways enabling some of the rioting and the violent activities of other kinds that they engaged in for months. This would seem to be a failing, made worse in a way by the now professed preoccupation of the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security, for that matter, with some of those, domestic opponents of the Democratic Party, for example, who are now being branded as terrorists and insurrectionists. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, I think there's three things that kind of, raise my eyebrows and cause concern with the FBI and other law enforcement agencies. Number one, their sloppy work that they did to gain access to foreign intelligence that was then used to monitor people in the previous administration. Again, you can't do that. The second thing is, they seem totally unprepared and unaware of the threats that were that are in the U.S. That are in the U.S. today. They were taken by surprise with the activities and the rioting and the events of this summer. And thirdly, as you point out, the robust activity by the Chinese, the Russians here inside of the United States. And so there's a clear focus on what the threats are. And the FBI needs to get, they need to get on top of these threats. And it is not, it's not the Republican Party. It's not conservatives. It's not libertarians. Even thinking about that or raising those prospects really, is really concerning. There's real threats, but those aren't it.
Yeah. Pete, let me just take advantage of the fact that you spent a lot of time in the U.S. Capitol and, of course, were a very senior leader in the House of Representatives for many years, to talk a little bit about where we find ourselves in the aftermath of this, shall we say, wholly unacceptable action by some against the Capitol itself. But now this transformation of what took place on the 6th of January into grounds for this bizarre impeachment of a man who's no longer the president of the United States.
It is a bizarre impeachment. If you go back and if you now take a look at the charges and say, that he incited and all of these types of things, I look at Washington today, and it's kind of become a witch hunt, and it has a chilling effect. It's forcing people to really, really, really be concerned about what they say, and we always should be, all right? But it's not to be concerned about whether what you're saying is accurate or not. It is now. It not only has to be accurate, it also has to be politically correct, and if you say something that's politically incorrect, you're attacked as violently as if you maybe say something that was inaccurate. And if you're making inaccurate statements, you ought to be held accountable. But we're seeing a narrowing of what is, approved political speech. And going outside of that is, gets to be very threatening. And it's chilling, I think, speech in America. And you take a look at, there's no excuse for what happened on January 6th. I was in the Netherlands. I was watching that the following morning. I was talking to my staff, and it almost brought me to tears. I mean, that is such a sacred building, sacred ground, and to see what was going on in that building. I talked to some of my colleagues as it was going on. They were in the safe spaces and secure areas of the Capitol, and I said, "Hey, is it as bad as what we're seeing on TV?" And, they came back and said, "Pete, we think it's, we're not quite sure exactly what you're seeing, but it's probably actually worse being here." And so, you know, we have problems facing America. We can't limit our speech. We can't be going after, I think, you know, we're beginning the process of, again, impeaching a president who's no longer in office. You have other scenarios going on in the House of Representatives where people are trying to hold representatives, you know, Cheney, Green, Omar, you know, to account for things that they either have done or they have said. And, you know, it's kind of like, hey, folks, we got real problems. Let's focus on the issues that are out there, and let's not try limiting free speech in our country.
Amen to the free speech point. That couldn't be more needed. And your voice in defending it, Congressman Ambassador Pete Hoekstra, is urgently needed. We're so glad you're back and at liberty to do just that. And we'll look forward to working with you closely at the Center for Security Policy in the days ahead. Thank you for your time today. And we'll have you on our television program, Securing America, tomorrow. And I'm very much looking forward to that as well. Keep up the great work, my friend, and God bless you and your family. And welcome home. Next up, we'll speak with David Wormser, also of the Center for Security Policy, about Iran and the threats we're facing from that quarter and what we best be doing about it. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by another of our colleagues at the Center for Security Policy. He is Dr. David Wormser. He is a senior fellow and the director of the Center's Project on Global Anti-Semitism and the U.S.-Israel Relationship. David, I want to sort of explore with you something that I talk about in my commentary today, which is the, well, I said in Breitbart this morning, it's almost like Stalin's technique of trying to obliterate Trotsky from Soviet photographs. The Biden team seems to want to disappear the Trump legacy, even though, I'd like your thoughts on this, it seems as though the Trump legacy, in stark contrast to that of Obama and what seems now in prospect with Biden, was a wild success compared to their failures. Is that how you see it, David, that we're teeing up a reprise of policies that have proven greatly unsatisfactory, shall we say, in the Middle East especially?
Oh, absolutely. I think not only are the policies returning, but they may be returning with a vengeance, maybe with some degree of additional problems and assumptions that are misguided. So, yeah, I think we're looking at Obama plus, so to speak, in the Middle East. And the problem with those policies are for 30, 40 years, they were tried again under near laboratory perfect conditions. They were applied and they all failed, and they failed multiple times. So the prospect of success or getting it right on the 13th or 15th time is extremely low.
Yeah. Einstein's line about insanity comes to mind, doesn't it? And unfortunately, in the interval, the world has gotten to be a lot more dangerous, notably because of the continued progress that the Iranian mullahocracy has clearly been making towards obtaining the nuclear weapons they've long sought. I have to tell you, I'm somewhat suspicious that they could possibly not have a bomb at this point, having been beavering away at it for so long. But give us your sense as an old intelligence officer of where the Iranian nuclear program is at the moment and how far, if at all, they are from having the most dangerous weapons in the world.
Well, they're not that far. I mean, the problem is that their behavior over the last month or two or three has been essentially what we would have all along considered breakout. The sudden increase of enrichment to 20%, which 20% isn't one-fifth the way to 100% or to the 90% or so that you need for a bomb. It's actually 90% of the way to the bomb. The difficult part is getting from the 3%+ to about 20%. So they're really at breakout levels. They're now amassing enough of this highly enriched uranium that it's sufficient for a bomb.
And the means by which they can take it to the remaining distance, these advanced centrifuges notably are in place and spinning away underground in places like Ferdow, a very heavily fortified and secret underground facility. They not?
Absolutely, they are. And on top of it all, these were things that couldn't have been done on 1 week's notice. This is the sort of stuff that was developed, produced, perfected, tested probably on a very tiny scale over the last 4 years in contravention for this supposedly strictly controlling agreement, the JCPOA, the Iran agreement, so to speak, that was supposed to have controlled all this. It didn't. Obviously, things were going on under the surface.
Under the surface, indeed, under the ground, right? But David, let me just ask you about that, because a lot of this was actually permitted under the agreement. Some unquestionably has been going on that's in contravention of it, but weren't they actually allowed to have access to these advanced centrifuges and to be using them, though they were supposed to not accumulate large quantities of this highly enriched uranium, to be sure. But a lot of the building blocks for this program were actually all, you know, acceptable under the terms of the agreement, were they not?
Yes. I mean, this is where the interpretation of things becomes so murky, and the Iranians will push the envelope in a way that serves their purpose. And we will, under Obama, we were pushing the envelope in terms of ignoring things so that we didn't have to face the consequences of reacting. The best example are these centrifuges. Technically, they're not supposed to operate them. They were supposed to put them in storage. The Iranians will claim, well, if we put gas in that isn't uranium, then we're not operating them. That's just putting gas in. Yet at the same time, that's how you test them. That's how you install them and make sure they're working and perfect them and fiddle with them and so forth. So the whole process of testing and putting a centrifuge on the proper footing is something that technically isn't uranium enrichment and therefore was arguably permitted under the JCPOA. But we saw this thing back in 2002, 2003. We asked them to freeze their nuclear enrichment activities. They agreed happily because they were in a testing phase where they didn't need to use uranium gas. They were using other gas.
But as soon as they were ready, they could use it. You know, David, you and I are of an age where you may remember, as I do, the debate over the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty that Ronald Reagan pursued with Mikhail Gorbachev. And one of the
at Reykjavik, yeah.
Debates was over whether they would have any SS-20s or none. And if they had any, they could have all of the infrastructure that would go along with deploying those missiles, and that would enable them to cheat. And I guess what you're saying basically is the Iranians have been allowed to have much of the infrastructure for their nuclear program, and some of it, again, is concealed, but some of it was legitimate, like having these advanced centrifuges and, you know, developing them further and so on. And once you've got that, it's just a matter of how far do they take it? Do they cheat? And how far do they then use it to break out? And this is one of the reasons why Trump was so right, it seems to me, to get out of that deal, and why Joe Biden is so wrong to be trying desperately to get back into it. The Iranians are establishing a number of preconditions. Our colleague Fred Flights at the Center for Security Policy has offered his own. Where do you think this is likely to go in terms of will there in fact be a new you know, sort of arrangement between the United States and the Iranians, getting us back into this deal or some other?
Sure, no. The Obama administration, the actual Obama administration, found out that it never had a plan B. So when the Iranians said no to terms, they had no choice but to accept those terms, accept the Iranian no and concede. The Biden administration is on the same track. They cannot be tougher than the Trump administration. They will not be the ones who actualize a threat against Iran for real. The Iranians know it. So when the Iranians lay down the law and they say, we will not accept, there's not a lot of leverage this Biden administration has to force them to accept it. In fact, there's no leverage because they've taken the threat of an American action, and frankly, even probably an Israeli action off the table.
That is a pregnant question, is are the Israelis who clearly are increasingly concerned, not just about the Iranian nuclear program being actualized, but about an America that no longer has its back, has the back of the Israelis as before under Trump. Do you think, in fact, they are going to have to exercise options that they have long warned they would use, if need be, to prevent the Iranians from actually getting the bomb?
I'm sure that they are thinking about it. I personally think that they will have little choice but to do that eventually. Unfortunately, in Israel, there's probably a similar fissure between security elites and among security elites and between security elites and the political echelon that they could paralyze themselves and tie themselves up in knots trying to interpret how America will react.
They're also in the midst of a new election for the prime minister as well, no less.
Exactly. However, every Israeli leader has said they will not allow Iran to get a bomb, and I really think that they are frightened that Iran is at the eve of a bomb. And so if their rhetoric will ever be acted upon, my sense is we're approaching that moment.
David, very quickly, what are the implications of the seeming stiffing of the United Arab Emirates by the Biden administration?
There just seems to be an allergy in the Biden administration to anything Trump did, whether it was good or bad. And this is a real dangerous circumstance. The core that Trump did was to empower our allies in the region to act more on their interests, but at the same time to carry water more for the alliance with us. Striking at the UAE is really an attempt to reestablish the old way of doing things in Washington, which is to tell our allies, sit on their hands, be restrained, don't pursue your interests. Instead, we'll be there for you. But then we're not. So we're not reliable. So at the end of the day, I think this is an allergy to what Trump did. They just cannot accept the fact that President Trump delivered four peace treaties, when on a theory that they insisted was impossible and succeeded within 3-4 years. And they never managed in the entire history of Israel to deliver 2 treaties, both of which, by the way, also were based on the same assumptions as Trump, that you can have a peace without the Palestinian issue being resolved. So their theory has been tried and failed, and they're frustrated that the counter theory has succeeded.
David Wormser, we will be watching closely what comes of all of this. I pray that it will not be a war, but I think the only way to avoid that is for the removal of the Iranian regime by its own people. And I think that will take our help. Let's pray that will be forthcoming. We will look forward to further visits with you, my friend. Thank you for your time today. Godspeed. Next up, we will speak with Susan Katz Keating of Just the News about some of the latest developments in the Defense Department and what they mean for you. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back and joined, I'm very pleased to say, by Susan Katz Keating. She is an award-winning writer and investigative journalist who has made her focus of a distinguished career terrorism and national security more generally. Currently, she is the chief national security correspondent for John Solomon's terrific new organization, Just the News. She has reported elsewhere and is an author of a book entitled The Prisoners of Hope, and always a welcome guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. Susan, thank you for finding some time for us. Good to catch up with you again.
It's great to be here. Good to talk to you, Frank.
I understand you have been on the investigative beat about what is going on in the nation formerly known as Burma, now called Myanmar, in the wake of this coup that has taken place at the hands of the military that long held power there and ceded it to a democratically elected government for a time and has now taken it back.
I have been, and in fact, just last night, I was on satellite phone to a former Green Beret who's on the ground in Burma now. So he gave me his fresh update on what's going on in his area of Karen State.
What's the state of play?
Well, according to him, the coup has not made a whole lot of difference in terms of the Karen, because he said they've been under attack for years anyway. And he said they always knew that the army was really in charge. He said this just brings it out into the open. He said this is just a way for everyone to acknowledge, actually, the army really is in charge here. But he said that there are hundreds of thousands of displaced people, particularly the ethnic groups. And he says with the Karen in particular, they are coming under fire in the northern area of the country. And it's just an ongoing crisis for them.
Mm-hmm. And what is the likelihood that the Chinese Communist Party will be among the beneficiaries of all of this?
I think they already are, because I think it's shown that in that area that brutality works, authoritarianism works, and I think that Communist Chinese Party would absolutely love to have an ally that gives them more geographical access to countries in the region.
And I think it's fair to say, Susan, if I'm not mistaken, that the Chinese Communist Party was very closely tied with this junta, or the military of Myanmar, at least for years. And so a restoration of its absolute control, not just behind the scenes, but in all aspects of the government, would probably be very welcome by the CCP, I imagine. Not so good for us, I suspect, or for the people of Burma, for sure. Let me switch gears and talk a little bit about another hotspot in Russia at the moment. Another, I think of him as communist, by the name of Vladimir Putin, certainly an old KGB operative, is under pressure from this remarkably courageous man, Alexei Navalny. What is your assessment of the state of Putin's autocracy as large numbers of Russians have in recent days rallied to Navalny's cause, and he has now been thrown in jail for another nearly 3 years?
I think in a lot of Alexei Navalny has really ripped the veil off the myth of Vladimir Putin, the strongman. You think of him as this invincible man. Navalny's got Putin scared. And I think Putin is actually walking right into Navalny's purposes. All Putin is doing is elevating Navalny at this point. He's making him even more of a cause celeb and a sympathetic figure. And Navalny, he's funny. He's charming. He makes jokes. You know, in his trial yesterday, he called Putin Putin the poisoner. That's who he's going to be known as in history. You know, I mean, it's funny.
Well, it's funny in the sense that he survived an effort to kill him, presumably at Vladimir Putin's direction, thanks to his exfiltration to Germany, where he was nursed back to health. But again, to his extraordinary credit, he turned around and went right back into Russia, knowing full well, I'm sure, that he would be badly treated, if not liquidated by Putin's regime. How significant do you think the mask having been pulled back is the actual opposition to Putin now inside Russia? Susan, is there any way of telling?
If you look at history, when mobs mobilize in Russia like this, it's usually a very serious thing. It's more serious than it is in our country. I think that there is a very pervasive groundswell against Putin, but you have to be very careful watching what happens next, because also traditionally, when the Russian government is on the rocks, they go outward. They attack somewhere else. They turn their aggression to another country. So I think this is a really delicate time for Ukraine and other countries in the region.
It is a delicate time. And to the extent that Joe Biden now is dealing with Putin, do you think it would be advisable for him to be showing a greater degree of support for this opposition movement and not get too close to Putin?
I think you have to be so careful with Putin. You have to talk to him, but again, you know, not give in and not, you know, fall prey into his maneuverings. I think what Biden needs to do is to talk to some actual, you know, Russia experts who know this field, not people who are just coming in, you know, and trying to, you know, bring in the new party policies.
We'll be watching it closely because there are reports from one of Biden's unauthorized biographers that Putin has dealt with Biden in the past rather contemptuously. And I suspect that that sentiment still persists on Putin's part, and I hope that it will stiffen Biden's spine as he deals with this thug and adversary, a very serious adversary at that.
I agree. I don't think Putin respects Biden.
No, I think that's kind of the point. I'm trying to remember the name of the author of this piece. Mike McCormick, who was a longtime translator for Joe Biden, has written Joe Biden Unauthorized, and it paints a very grim picture of the Russian president's contempt for Joe Biden. And I have the feeling that that should stiffen our president's spine in dealing with him. We'll be watching it closely with you, Susan Katz Keating. Let me turn finally to another, important profile in Courage, it seems to me. And that is a major in the United States Army by the name of Andrew Calvert. He is a chaplain, and you wrote last month, Susan, about his challenging, effectively, the advisability of having transgender individuals in the United States Armed Forces, which, of course, is something that Joe Biden, as part of his retooling of the Trump presidential executive orders, has now made possible. Tell us about Major Calvert and what he has said and what is likely to befall him, alas, as a result.
Boy, the hammer has come down on him. I'll tell you, Frank, he posted on Facebook under a post about the new transgender policy, and he questioned whether transgender people are mentally fit to serve. And it just spiraled from there. The Army.
Let's read the full quote, if we can, because I think this is really important. He said, quote, "How is rejecting reality, parentheses biology, not evidence that a person is mentally unfit and thus making that person unqualified to serve," unquote. He said there's little difference in this than over those who believe and argue for a flat earth, despite the overwhelming evidence to the contrary, unquote. That seems to be an eminently serious and sensible thing to say, doesn't it?
It does, and he, as a chaplain, would be fully within his purview to raise this issue. But also, he later on, in another thread that I don't have, raised the issue of, statistically, transgender people do have a higher rate of depression and attempted suicide. It's and to put them in a situation where they're going to be even more stressed, he said, is just, it's inhumane.
Right. And a threat, in fact, to, the readiness and fighting capability of the units in which they serve as well. Susan, we have to come back to you on this. This is an important topic, and I hope we can follow this brave chaplain's sort of story going forward, and that you'll keep your eye on it at Just the News. We appreciate so much your visiting with us, and let's do it again soon. I hope we'll have a visit with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.